What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning in to the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight. Man, I got a hot show for you today. On the phone with me, I have a very well-accomplished drummer percussionist who's played with everybody in the business, from Cameo to Patti LaBelle, and the one and only Prince. He is also on the board of directors for Teach the Dream Foundation. Please welcome drummer percussionist John Blackwell Jr.
Hey, Spud, what's up?
Hey, what's happening, John?
Oh, man. Can't complain.
Oh, man. Dude, I just want to take my hat off to you, John. From one musician to another, man. I've seen you in action. I've listened to your tracks. It's just phenomenal, man. It's just truly amazing with your skill level as a drummer, dude. It's just off the meters.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Man, how did you start playing? I mean, I know you've went to the Berklee College of Music out in Boston, and I'm pretty sure music was just kind of like your vision growing up, just like mine was, man. But, you know, how and when did you break into the business performing with Cameo and Prince and Patti LaBelle?
Pretty much it started back with my father, John Blackwell Sr. He was a drummer, still is a drummer. And he performed with the Drifters, Spinners, Joe Simon, J.J. Jackson, King Curtis, and Mary Wells. You know, he performed with a few people himself. And then when I came along in 73, you know, I was born in 73, and my father pretty much started, you know, doing what he went to college for, which was engineering, and he settled down with, you know, my mom's and my older sister and then myself, and he just started doing gigs on the weekends instead of where he was using that as a, using drumming as his main source of income. He switched from that to just doing a full-time gig as an engineer for phone companies and stuff like that. And around age two, you know, I which is my first parts of memory, I remember everything from two and up. I never forget, I asked him, told him that I wanted to be a drummer, and I wanted a drum set. And he was like, oh, yeah, I'll get you a set, son. So around age three, he bought me my first drum kit. And from then on, it's just been drums for me. You know, first beat I ever played on a drum set was Brick House by the Commodores.
Okay.
Yeah, and my father always, you know, he always took me to concerts. From that age up, you know, anytime anybody came through Columbia, South Carolina, which is where I was born and raised, everything from Sister Sledge, which was the first concert I ever remember of life, you know, and then the Commodores, Teddy Pendergrass, Mark Hayes, Marvin Gaye, Maze, Frankie Beverly, and Atlantic Star, and so many others. I had the opportunity to actually seeing the Jacksons in '84 on the Victory Tour, and so many concerts that my dad took me to, you know, Cameo, Gap Band, you know, right. So. That's all I thought about, you know. So music, you know, which is why I never got my lessons in high school. I was so busy remembering the show from last night and wasn't thinking about English or history.
No, I hear you there, man. I mean, you know, we kind of think the same way, man. You know, growing up, I mean, I started music at a young age also, man. I've been playing forever, but I really started tracking and recording when I was about 14. I had my own 8-track studio, man, and, you know, just getting into the MIDI thing around 87, 88, you know, so, I mean, when I'm in school, man, everyone's focused on swears. Like, man, I'm going home working on my demo.
Right.
You know, it's like, man, I was in, you know, 8th, 9th grade. I'm carrying around my cassette tapes in my pocket, man, just hoping I might pop up on somebody. So, yeah.
Hey, we run along the same lines. I was carrying around a stick bag, you know.
Oh, yeah.
A set of symbols instead of my books, you know, but it got so bad they had to give me a tutor.
Oh, man.
otherwise, I wouldn't have got out of high school in time, but, I kind of regret that, you know. So I always, when I do seminars and clinics, I always, you know, especially if I do high school stuff, I tell the kids, you know, books is very important, you know, get your lessons and get the academic under your belt. You know, so you won't have to be on academic probation like I was when I started at Berkeley, you know.
Right. But you know what's nice? What I found out as I got older, man, is like the discipline that it takes to study music, especially your craft as a musician, if you're playing keyboards, drums, bass, what have you. I think you'll pick up better study habits being an adult because you really know how to utilize your mind a little bit better for focus.
Right.
Than when you're young. At least it was for me, man. I mean, I found myself studying more now as an adult than when I was younger. So.
Well, yeah, the same here, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, your influences as a drummer, John, I mean, there's so many else. Other great drummers out there, man. Who was kind of like your go-to guy for, you know, picking up chops and really finding that pocket as a drummer?
Well, I have to separate those. When it comes to chops, you know, I go back to all the greats from back in the day, like Elvin Jones, Roy Haynes, Art Blakey, and Tony Williams, one of my all-time favorites, and Billy Cobham, you know, another big great, and my one of my best friends at this point in time, Dennis Chambers. You know, I listen to those guys. Those are my go-to guys for chops and stuff. But when it comes to playing in the pocket, you know, which is something which was my foundation. My father was known around the Southeast region as, you know, they called him Pocket Man because that's all he thought about, and that's all he focused on was like grooving, you know, just being the main force behind a funk band or whatever it may be. You know, so my father was one of my main sources for Pocket. Another guy that I learned from, you know, who was a good friend of my father's, the late great Yogi Horton, who was the drummer for Ashford and Simpson, and was the drummer for Luther Vandross until his untimely death in 1987. You know, Steve Gadd, another great pocket drummer, a big influence on my playing to this day, and you know, Questlove. Another one, you know, that's like I listen to him a lot, and the late great Jay Dilla, you know, another great, you know, a lot of people didn't know it. He was a great drummer and a great drum programmer,
right?
You know, for some serious stuff that's out there, that's still out right now to this day. So many people, you know, and then Larry Blackman from Cameo, you know.
Oh yeah.
Diamond from the Ohio Players, you know, so many drummers, you know, Michael Beard, Barcades, you know.
You know, one drummer that sticks out to me, man, Jellybean Johnson from The Time.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got to mention Jelly. Cause
hey, man, I'm a Minneapolis guy, man, so you know.
Hey, I'm sorry, I totally forgot about that, you know, but that's another big hero, man. Me and Jelly being a good friends, and also Prince. A lot of people don't know it, but Prince played on a lot of his earlier records.
Oh yeah,
Versi and Dirty Mind, and the earlier albums in 1999, and
Prince
all that
for
stuff.
You? Oh yeah,
he was the drummer. Mm-hmm. He was the drummer, and Morris Day was drumming on a lot of that Prince stuff.
Oh,
a lot
yeah.
of people. Oh, Morris is a great drummer. I mean, he's like. Morris's influences is David Garibaldi and from Tower Power and so many other drummers, you know. So, you know, I mean, there's so many, and that's my foundation. I didn't learn jazz, and I didn't pick up on Billy Cobham and Tony Williams until like my sophomore, junior year of high school. But from early on, all I listened to was, you know, Parliament, Prince, you know, Cameo, and Ohio Players, the Isley Brothers, and
building a foundation for funk.
you know, Ernie Isley, another serious drummer. A lot of people they know him as a guitar player, but
right.
That's playing on all that early Isley Brothers stuff. Like, and one of my favorite beats from Ernie was "Footsteps in the Dark."
Oh yeah,
that track, man. You know.
Yeah.
So you know, that's my foundation for chops and for my foundation for pocket too. You know, those are the guys I go to. Those are my go-to guys.
You know, I think every drummer, man's got some sort of finesse and a signature that's identifiable to them on the tracks and records. What would you define your sound as?
Oh, man.
I mean, because you're so versatile as a player, though, man, but I feel that everybody's got that zone. It's like, man, if I get here at this tempo and this style of track, man, I'm going to town on it.
Wow, that's nobody ever put it to me that way. Asked me what my signature sound would be, you know.
Sure.
I don't know. You know, I mean, it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, yeah, it's certain feels that every drummer does that you can be like, oh yeah, that's blah 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 blah. You know, I know when I hear Dennis Chambers, I know when I hear Steve Gadd, I'm gonna hear, you know, it's you know, they can't help it but do one of their signature feels or moves on a track.
Right.
And I can't describe it, but if I heard something that I played on, I know I can identify it. I don't know if I'm putting that right, but
I got you.
I can tell if it's me or if it's not me.
Right.
I don't know. You know, it's something that would have to be heard. You know, and then I can be like, I can explain. Okay, yeah, that's blah blah blah. That's all right. No, that's me on that track. I remember that. I can't describe it over the phone or. You know, it'll have to be a track playing or something like that for me to say, oh yeah. You know.
Right. No, I got you. I mean, again, too, man, because you're so versatile. I think with people who have such versatility and you play with so many different people, I mean, it you kind of have so many different styles and, you know, good, you know, things that you could pull out. It's like, man, this is where I stand out as a player. So, no, I agree with you.
Yeah.
You know, man, as a drummer, I like talking to drummers a little bit about the recording aspects. You know, how you're tracking the drums, what format you're using, what mic and pre's. Do you have any favorites that you're using out there for your signal chain for your drums?
Well, for miking, you know, I'm a sure microphone endorser. So usually, you know, when the engineer mics me up, you know. Sometimes I prefer them to, you know, go with the Shure equipment. But sometimes I let them do what they want to do.
Sure.
As far as, huh?
I was going to say, are you using like the SM57s or 58s? Or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, when I was with Prince, you know, I never forget this one session. This engineer, he put some kind of microphone on my snare, and Prince pretty much was like, wait a minute, he said, that's not an FM 57, is it? And he said, no, it's an AKG, blah, blah, blah. Prince said, go get the SM 57. right now. And I was like, oh, okay, this dude about to get rimmed. You don't get that SM57 on this mic, on this drum.
Man, that's got to be the most used mic live in a recording for drums that I've ever seen, ever.
Still to this day, man.
And it's an old mic, man.
Because, you know, it's the old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right.
And you know, it does what it's supposed to do. And, you know, so, you know, for preamps for me, you know, that Neve, those Neve 1073s for preamps that's a must for my drum sound. It's a must. You know, I have to have those preamps on my drums, because, you know, when you listen back, man, those drums are so, I mean, the sound that you get from those pre's,
yeah,
it's so warm, you know, and the drums just, I mean, when I, matter of fact, I did a session the other day for John Setter with the Teach to Dream project, and when I listened, when I was in a drum booth, and from the drum booth, I'm like, man, these drummers are, and I don't like the sound of this. This sounds horrible. But when we stopped for a minute, he said, all right, I got to do a playback. I got to listen to what's going on. So when he played it back, I had my headphones on. I could hear the drums, and the drums sounded totally different. Yeah. And they sounded beautiful with, you know, through those pre's. And I was like, man, I wish I had that sound up in here in the booth.
Right, right.
You know, like, man, because they sound, I don't hear that when I'm in there, you know.
Right.
But, you know, that's kind of like, you know, that's my, you know, profession. That's my, that's what I prefer.
Definitely.
You know,
right.
when I'm in, you know, recording mode.
Now, are you tracking and recording your own? Do you have your own engineer when you're recording?
For the latest project I've done, which is my album and John Blackwell project, my manager chose the engineer during the recording time, but for mastering and things like that, we used Grammy Award winning recording engineer Michael Vale Blum. Who's been on many Grammy winning, you know, recordings and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, he's a veteran.
Yeah. So we used him, and he did an excellent job. Did an excellent job for what we were going for and what we were looking for as a finished product. Prince, you know, Prince pretty much does everything himself when it comes to, you know, recording and engineering everything. He does it himself, and, you know, he knows what he wants. He has his sound, and we've all heard this sound many times on many records.
Mm-hmm.
So he pretty much handles that on his own. I haven't, far as with, you know, I can't remember the engineers that were on the P. Diddy projects that I recorded with. And I didn't record with Patti LaBelle or Cameo. You know, so, but, you know, most of my time lately, from 2000 and up, was always Prince, or, and then from that point to now, you know, it was Michael Vale Blum and the other engineer that we used for my project.
Sure. You know, I gotta ask, man, how was it, and give me the experience, man, from beginning to the end stages working with Prince, because I'm a huge fan, I gotta know.
I pretty much, you know, the experience was, wow, the experience was, you know, it was great, you know, it was a big chunk of my life, actually, you know, me and, you know, we, you know, I had my good times, and I had my bad times there, you know. And it's such a big honor, you know, because you got to think about it. I mean, from age 8 or 7 to, you know, to the year 99, you know, I was a big Prince fan.
Right.
And when you're young, you know, when you're a kid, you think, because they're out at that time and point, you don't think by the time you hit their age, you know, when they were, you know, when they were doing their thing, you don't think that you'll be able to play with these guys.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I never forget when I was a kid, I had to practice every day. My mom made me practice every day before I could go outside and play with my friends. And at age 8, I'll never forget, I was practicing and my friends were at the door listening to me, you know, and they're practicing, and they knocked on the door, and then finally my mom said, all right, you can go outside and play with your friends since you practice a good bit. Okay, so go play. So I go outside, and everybody's like, man, you killing in there on those drums, Kenny. You know, that's my nickname. And you know, I was like, thanks, man. And one of my friends said, and I'll never forget, he said, man, one day, John, you're going to play for Prince or Michael Jackson. And I was like, wow. I said, that would be cool, you know.
Right.
And they said, if you had a choice, who would you want to play for? And, of course, I would want to play for both, but the first thing that was out of my mouth was Prince.
Right.
I said, I want to play for Prince. And they said, why? I said, well, Prince, you know, he plays, he's
a musician, right. You can relate to him.
Yeah, you know. So, you know, that was always my vision, was either I will be up there one day with Prince or I'll be up there with Michael Jackson.
Right.
And I got that opportunity in 99 when I was working with Patti LaBelle. You know, Prince, you know, he came up to me after a concert that we was doing in Minneapolis, actually. And it was him and Larry Graham sitting on the side of the stage watching me. And I'll never forget, he actually, he told me when he saw me that night, he was listening to me, and he said, man, if I can get this kid right here in my band, I could really make something out of him. So him and Larry went to the side of the stage to get a closer look from what he told me. And I was up there, I was, you know, backing Patti up as best I could, and
on eggshells the whole night.
Huh?
So you probably on eggshells the whole night, man.
Well, you know what? See, the thing is, they didn't want me to see them, and it was great that they didn't want that.
Right.
Because if I would have saw them on the side of the stage, if I would have saw them, I would have acted the fool.
Oh yeah.
We probably won't be on the phone right now talking. You know, because the bass player saw them, and he was nuts. You know, because he saw Larry Graham sitting there with Prince, and he was, you know, of course, you know, he had a better vision from where he was standing than I did.
Right.
So he says, John, you know, Patty's singing, and I'm focused on Patty, and he kept calling me, and he's like, John, and he's playing his bass, and I'm like, what, man? He said, man, look on the side of the stage. So he looked. I looked over there, and I guess they saw when the bass player pointed to them to tell me to look. So they kind of backed up even further, so I couldn't see. They were so far back in the dark on the side of stage. I didn't know who they were. So I was like, man, I said, dude, focus on Patty. She's
right.
Saying, what are you doing? You know. So after the show was over, you know, the curtain closes. Bass player. Still in like this, you know, excited mode, and he throws his bass off and he runs straight for Larry Graham. But when he came up to Larry, Larry pretty much pushed him out of the way to get to me. So at that point, I'm like, I got my mouth wide open. I'm like, oh my God, this is Larry Graham.
Wow.
I had no idea. So Larry came up to me and he said, oh man, he said, I feel a connection between me and you. Oh man, you sound so good. He said, here's my card. Will you please stay in touch with me? And I was like, yeah, of course. I'm going to stay in touch with you, man. And then at that point, after that, Prince walked up. And then at that point, I started pinching my arm. I was like, I got to be dreaming.
Right.
I said, this can't be real right now. So Prince walked up, and he was like, he said, my God, you're unbelievable. And I was like, whoa. I said, whoa. And he says, I'll see you soon. And he just walked away.
Wow.
I was like, wait a minute. You know, you see me soon. You didn't take my number. You didn't get my email address.
He'll get a hold of you.
Yeah. And then I was thinking to myself, I was like, how is he going to stay in touch? But I didn't realize that the connection would be Larry.
Right.
So through Larry, that connection happened. And then, of course, Prince followed us. He was in New York, when Patty and Chaka Khan were on the same show in Madison Square Garden Theater. Prince came to that show and sat in with Chaka. And again, he came up to me, and that's when he invited me. And I was thinking to myself, I was like, man, here's Prince again. I said, I probably won't ever get another chance. I'm gonna just ask him, can we jam or something one day? And before I could even say that, he said, me and you should jam one day. I was like, wow. I said, I would love that. He said, when the tour is over with, he said, give me a call. And I was still at that point, I'm like, I don't have your number, man. How am I supposed to call you? But, you know, I told Larry, when the tour was over with, you know, I said, hey, Larry, you know, Prince said, wanted me to come up there and jam with you guys. And Larry said, I'll let him know. And then next thing you know, Paisley Park called me and they flew me up. I came in, I jammed, you know, with Prince. You know, and Prince was switching from one instrument to another, and while I was playing drums, and Larry came in, and then it turned into a power trio thing, and that was awesome.
Wow.
And I was like, Prince and Larry Graham and me. I was like, whoa, you know, this is crazy. And after the jam was over, you know, because we jammed the whole day, you know, he says, all right, man, he says, thanks for coming. And I was like, that's it? I said, wait. I got something up my sleeve. I ain't gonna let him walk out of here without me playing this beat for him. And the beat I played for him was, I studied it. I tried to learn it and craft it as best I could. I played 7-7-7-93-11 for him.
Ooh.
And I played it just like the drum machine, or at least as close as possible.
Right.
You know, and he turned around quick, and he ran to his base. Prince ran to his base, and we jammed on that one. We jammed on that for a good minute, just me and Prince.
That's all pocket right there, that song, man.
Yeah. And after that, he was like, all right, man. He said, I'll be calling you. And he called me up a couple of times, you know, between then and from that point until like 8 months later. And then finally, 8 months later, he asked me to join MPG. And I said, yes, I'll be honored, sir. You know, I was like, yes.
Right.
Well, would you say no?
Let me think about it, man. Let me get back to you again.
Yeah, yeah. Let me say, I got a local gig at a country bar now in South Carolina. I don't know if I can let that go.
Right.
Man, please. I was like, yeah.
Definitely.
And that pretty much started, you know, the whole adventure, not, you know, job. It was an adventure,
right?
Of me working with Prince.
Because of all of your experiences, John, what do you feel you find that creative zone, man, in the studio where it's more structured, or on that stage, pulling from your band members and the audience?
Where do I find my creativity?
Your creative zone. You know, I feel that every musician's got that zone, man.
I guess it starts from it's at the moment.
Sure.
And then it's from, you know, A lot of it comes from just experience and watching other greats, and also from the dressing room. You know, in the dressing room, I like to listen to music to get myself prepared for that show. For every show. And, I think that's pretty much how I come up with things. It's just that at the spur of the moment, it's a vibe that forms when I'm on stage with the band. Right. And pretty much it's almost like we're all thinking from the same brain, from the same level.
Right.
You know, it's like a gelling of all of us becoming one. And just thinking ahead, thinking of the music as a finished product, you know. Something I learned from Prince, you know. Prince always told me to always, you know, when you're performing or recording, always, even though, think of the song as if it was your song, and think of it as a finished product in your mind. You know, something that, you know, like, what would you want to hear as a finished product?
Right.
You know, it's weird, you know. Huh?
It makes sense.
Yeah. It makes sense. You know, it's just a certain way of thinking, you know, and creativity that he taught me. You know, it's kind of hard to grasp at first, but, you know, I was very quick to learn it. And
that's kind of, you got to think like a producer almost, as a musician, you know what I mean?
Right, it's right. Like which helped out for me doing my own thing now, you know, which helped out for, you know, how I thought about the John Blackwell Project.
Right.
You know, yeah, the songs that I wrote with Charlie Singleton and all the guys in the band, you know, I pretty much thought of it. I had to listen to, even though they were my songs, I still had to perform them to finish them. So, you know, I had to think ahead of the song being finished.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
If you understand where I'm coming from.
I do, man. I'm a producer. You know what I mean? And, you know, when I'm producing an artist, you know, I kind of have to know the project ahead of time when I'm working with an artist, kind of sketch things out of my head before I actually lay things down. You got a couple of ideas, but one thing I do as a producer, you know, I have a basic foundation track, you know, for the artist to perform and sing over. And when they leave the studio, I usually just strip all the music down, man. I really build my music around the pre-existing vocals I have laid already.
By
the time they hear it, I was like, wow, it didn't sound like that. Let me do something over this, because now they see the big picture. So, yeah.
That happened many a times with me and Prince. I remember when we did the Rainbow Children album. There's a track on that album called Everywhere. And pretty much, that song started with me. Prince was mic checking, you know, he's doing a sound check in the studio. And he's like, okay, John, play the toms, you know, give me a kick drum, give me a snare drum, give me the cymbals, the overhead mics, all that, give me all that. All right, give me the hi-hat, and I play everything. And I started playing this Latin beat. You know, it's like do 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 do. And he said, keep that going. He said, just play that for a few minutes. So I played it. I kept playing it. And he told me to do some little fills here or there. And I did that. And he said, all right, thanks. And I was like, what? He said, go back to the hotel. I'll call you back tomorrow. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I come back the next day, and he done made a song around that beat.
Wow.
You know, he took everything and put it around the beat. I mean, vocals, everything was done. I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was like, man, this, you know, it was amazing. I was like, wow, I can't believe this.
Oh yeah, man, that's the art of production, man. I love it.
Yeah, you know.
You know, John, you're also serving as a board member on the Teach the Dream Foundation.
Yeah.
What is your role there, man? And, you know, explain to me a little bit about the foundation and what it represents and its mission.
I guess it's a project that started by a guy named John Fetter, who's, you know, it's basically a foundation, I guess, to keep, you know, to keep, you know, keep young kids inspired to perform and I guess shooting for you know, their dreams or whatever, you know. I mean, I just came a member. I just came aboard recently.
Okay.
And you know, John explained to me what he was trying to do and what he's trying to do with it, and Willie also, who actually brought me on this show with you guys, you know. And you know, it's a real cool, it's kinda like Save the Music Foundation. It's kinda like that same, in that same realm. You know, keeping music alive and keeping real music alive in the children. Right. You know, pretty much just trying to keep that thing going, you know, because, you know, this day and age, you know, there's so, you know, so many, it's so much technology going on in music, and there's not enough live musicians performing it like it used to be. And I think one of the goals of this project is to you know, to keep that going and to get more children playing real instruments again, you know, so that,
yeah,
you know, to keep that live instrumentation thing going.
It has died down quite a bit, man. I mean, like I said, you and I, man, we're the same age, and like I said, I remember, man, in 87, 88, 89, I mean, my main focus, because at that time, there were no DAW system, everything was analog recording back in the 80s.
Right.
You know, so all I could really do at that time was really focus on being a great keyboardist and, you know, playing a little guitar and bass, and just really focusing my talent as a musician. And, you know, I was still tracking and engineering small scale 8-track, you know, and it just where my stuff is leveled. You know, there wasn't until like 2000 is where I really got into the DAW world and we started doing digital recording. But man, that whole time, man, I was a keyboard player playing covers, you know, tracking and just really learning my craft. But now, man, I mean, because of technology, I mean, it's great for the seasoned musician, but for the new guy coming up out of his bedroom, has no experience with the a piano or keyboard, he's tracking, creating beats. I mean, it's not taking anything because it's constructive, but you really just, you miss out a lot, man, on the music side of it, to me.
It's I don't find anything wrong with, you know, programming and the way things are run in the studio these days. What I do have a problem with, and I may not, I shouldn't say this. Some people might not say, all right, well, we won't call you then. I can't stand the fact that, you know, I come to a big show, you know, and sometimes I usually have access backstage with some, you know, some buddies or friends who are in that band. And, or I may be on the tour and they got some big computer with digital performer or whatever running the show under the stage.
Yeah.
And everything has to be played so perfect every night, the same thing.
Yeah, playing over track music's bad, man.
Yeah, I can't stand that.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, music has gotten so, everybody's gotten so addicted, or at least a lot of people have gotten so addicted to that, that some cats have forgot how to perform a show, an entire say for surely stays far, far, far away from that.
Yeah.
Everything that you do with Prince, you got to be playing the entire show, because he comes from the school from back in the day where everything, there was no digital performer back then.
No.
And and it has to be so tight to the point to where one time I was on this tour. I'm not going to say what tour it was, but, you know, me and one of the guitar players who played with Prince, we was on this tour together, and we popped in one of our tapes from some TV show, TV performances and live performances that we did with Prince. And the guy, I mean, we wasn't with Prince, we was with another band. And one of the band members from that band was like, "Oh man, was that show sequenced?" And we looked at him like, "No, that is us, 100%.
Real time, no digital, man.
real live. You know, that's all the way live. There ain't no digital performer or none of that other stuff. That Logic or all that. There ain't none of that. That's us.
Right.
All night, 3.5 hours.
Right.
You know, sick, sleepy, tired, whatever. We play our tail off when we got on that stage.
Right.
And we were all locked in the pocket. Without a computer assisting us.
Right.
None of that is going on that stage. They were like, "Oh man, wow."
Right. But you know, I think it too, man, it is, for me as a producer, man, it's like when you're in the studio, one thing that I try to keep in bear in mind is that, man, if I'm producing an artist, I would like for the artist to perform my song on stage with the band. But if I'm writing sequence parts where band members can't play it, you'll play it note for note. But is it that particular sound for that album? No, you're not using real guitars. You're using keyboard guitars. So that tone is going to change when you get another guitar player on stage. So, you know, I think a lot of guys who are prolific and really trying to build a big sound, it's going to start it from the studio first, so it translates well on stage. You know what I mean? So I think Prince, right, and everyone is doing that. That's why those records sound great on tour, man, because that thing was produced in the studio for a live playing ability. So, yeah, I agree.
That's why Prince chose who he has an ear for who he wants.
Right.
And who he feels that's going to get the job done. I'll never forget Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis said some. They said, you know, when you're working with Prince, he'll make you think that you're Superman. I mean, and he's not kidding. You know, I mean, he'll have you doing things that you never thought you could do.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I remember on the Musicology tour in 2004, there was a guy in playing keyboards for us, Renato Netto. And Renato Netto, this guy actually played this keyboard part on "When Doves Cry." He's like, digga 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 digga.
Doc B did that.
And Prince said they had some kind of, I forgot how he said that was played or something. I don't know if he was kidding or not, but Renato played that thing note for note himself, you know. And it got so funny to the point where Renato would play it like if you sped a record up with your hand,
sure,
and make it go real fast. He played it that fast.
Oh yeah.
And Prince looked at him like, "Oh, wise guy." I was like, man, I couldn't believe it. I mean, because I thought they were going to use some kind of machine to play that part, but Renato was playing that thing note for note.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know.
But, man, what do you got on the musical agenda for 2010, John? I mean, I know you got a lot of things popping, man. Give me some specifics and some details where you're headed.
Trying to 2010, continuing to write new music. I got one record under my belt now, and I'm already working on the next album. Just continuing to focus on the John Blackwell project, which is out on, you can buy it off of DickStation.com, CDBaby.com, and iTunes.com, or iTunes, I'm sorry. I don't know if it's .com or not.
It's iTunes, it's cool.
Yeah, iTunes, you know, you can buy it on iTunes. Very proud of that, you know, that album. And it's basically an album that I wrote for my daughter, who tragically drowned in 2004 while I was on tour. My daughter Gia.
Sorry to hear that.
Thank you. The name of the album is Forever Gia, and by the John Blackwell Project. When I had a vision for the record, I didn't want the CD, or that's why I say record. I didn't want the CD to be just one genre of music. I didn't want it to be just R&B. I didn't want it to be just fusion. I didn't want it to be just jazz or hip hop or anything. I wanted it to have everything on it. I wanted it to have pretty much something for everybody.
Right.
You know, whether you're a jazz lover, whether you're a hip hop lover, whether you're an old school R&B lover, a jazz lover, I wanted this record to be able to please everybody for whatever style that they like, and I believe I pretty much got close to that. I'm getting a lot of good feedback, and from a lot of people who've picked it up, and everybody's the thing that everybody's saying is that it's something for everybody on this record, and I'm proud of the musicians who I worked with. I worked with David Garfield, Michael Landau, Esperanza Spalding, Charlie Singleton from Cameo, and David Mann from Tower of Power, and Will Lee, the great Will Lee, bass player, Paul Pesco, guitar player from The System, from Hall & Oates, from Madonna, from J-Lo, you name it, and new young gun on the scene, keyboard player Corey Bernhardt. And pretty much I'm very proud of this record and just focusing on that, and doing a lot of clinic tours and things like that on my own, but hopefully very soon I'll be able to perform with my band on some jazz festivals or whatever it may be, some TV shows or whatever. And just continuing to write some great music,
That's tight, man.
Yeah, that's 2010 and onward and upward.
Good deal. Well, John, man, I appreciate you coming on the show, man. It's been a true honor and pleasure, man. You always got a spot here, man.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you.
Man, we got to get together and jam one day, man.
Oh, yeah, we definitely got to do that.
For sure, man. Well, we'll touch base. We'll keep in touch. We'll make that happen, brother.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Well, you take it easy, man. Have a good one.
All right, you take care.
All right.
Bye.
And a big shout out to John Blackwell for coming on the show and chopping it up with me, man. You know, it was truly an honor, man, because for one, I'm a fan of his work. I mean, and if you haven't seen him in person, you definitely got to check him out on YouTube, man. There's a couple of clips that he's performing live, and, you know, just to see what he does, man, it's just, again, it's just going to blow you away. So I recommend you checking him out on YouTube, man. And thank you again, John, for coming on the show, man. You definitely got a spot here at the Producer's Corner, man. I'd love to have you back, brother. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit me up on iTunes under the podcast, man. I host a podcast on iTunes, and that's on the iTunes store. You just click on the podcast section and type in The Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight. And also, you can hit my website up as well at www.spudtootightmusic.ning.com. And again, that's spudtootightmusic.ning.com. And for questions and suggestions, you can hit my email up at spudtootight@gmail.com. Again, that's spudtootight@gmail.com. And for the remainder of the show, man, I'm going to let the track play out. You're listening to currently. It's off John's CD. And the title of the track is called You're the One. So the remainder of the show, man, we're just going to let the track play out and close the show, man. And it's just a hot track, man. I had to let this play and let it go through. So again, I want to thank everybody for listening in and tuning in. Until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace. You're too good to be true. Yeah. And no, I'm so in love with you, babe. And I can
can work with that. Bring it, Blackwell. Hey!